killed.
There was nothing more to be learned from him at present, and Dalgliesh told him that he could go, first warning them both that the information they had given must be kept absolutely secret. They had clearly put themselves in danger of the charge of obstructing the police, if not something more serious. Sergeant Robbins would now go with Surtees to recover the keys, which would be kept in police possession. Both gave the assurance demanded. Eric Surtees, with as much formality as if taking a solemn oath, his sister ungraciously. As Surtees finally got up to go, his half-sister got up too, but Dalgliesh said, "I'd like you to stay if you would, Miss Surtees. I've one or two further questions." As the door closed behind her half-brother, Dalgliesh said, "When I first began talking to your brother, he said that you wanted him to get you another wafer. So this wasn't the first time. An earlier attempt had been made. What happened on the first occasion?" She sat very still, but her voice was composed when she answered. Eric made a slip of the tongue. "There was only this once." "I don't think so. Of course, I could get him back and ask him, and indeed I shall ask him. But it would be simpler if you explained to me now what happened on the previous occasion." She said defensively, "It had nothing to do with this murder. It happened last term. I must be the judge of what relates to this murder. Who stole the wafer for you the time before?" "It wasn't stolen that time, not precisely. It was handed over to me."
"Was it by Ronald Treves?"
"Yes, it was, if you must know. Some of the wafers are consecrated and taken to churches round about where temporarily there isn't a priest and where there's to be Holy Communion. The wafers are consecrated and taken to the church by whoever is going to take or help with the service. That was Ronald's job that week. And he took out one wafer for me. One wafer out of so many. It was a small thing to ask." Kate suddenly intervened. "You must have known that it wasn't a small thing for him to do. How did you pay him? The obvious way?" The girl flushed, but with anger, not embarrassment. For a moment, Dalgliesh thought she would flare into open antagonism. It would, he thought, have been justified. He said quietly, "I'm sorry if you find that offensive. I'll rephrase it. How did you manage to persuade him?" Her momentary outrage was over. Now she looked at him from narrowed, calculating eyes, then visibly relaxed. He could identify the second when she realized that candor would be more prudent and perhaps more satisfying. She said, "All right. I persuaded him in the obvious way, and if you're thinking of handing out moral judgment, you can forget it. Anyway, it's none of your business." She glanced over at Kate, and the look was frankly hostile. "Or hers. And I don't see what relevance all this has to the Archdeacon's murder. They can't possibly be related." Dalgliesh said, "The truth is that I can't be sure. They could be. If they aren't, none of this will be used. I'm not asking about the theft of the wafer out of prurient curiosity about your private life." She said, "Look, I rather liked Ronald. Okay, maybe it was more that I felt sorry for him. He wasn't exactly popular here. Papa too rich, too powerful, wrong business too. In armaments, isn't he? Anyway, Ronald didn't really fit in. When I came down to stay with Eric, we'd meet occasionally and walk along the cliffs to the mere. We'd talk. He told me things you wouldn't be able to get out of him in a million years, and nor would these priests, confession or no confession. And I did him a favor. He was 23 and a virgin. Look, he was desperate for sex, dying for it." Perhaps, thought Dalgliesh, he had died for it. He heard the continuing voice. Seducing him wasn't exactly a chore. Men make a fuss about seducing female virgins. God knows why. Exhausting and unrewarding, I'd have thought. But the other way has its excitements. And if you want to know how we kept it from Eric,
We didn't go to bed in the cottage. We made love in the bracken on the cliffs. He was a damn sight luckier to have me initiating him than going with a whore, which he had tried once and then got so disgusted he couldn't see it through. She paused, and as Dalgliesh didn't speak, went on more defensively. He was training to be a priest, wasn't he? What use would he be to other people if he hadn't lived? He used to go on about the grace of celibacy, and I suppose celibacy is all right if that's your thing, but believe me, it wasn't his. He was lucky to find me. Dalgliesh said, "What happened to the wafer?" "Oh, God, that was bad luck. You'll hardly believe this. I lost it. I put it into a plain envelope and pushed it into my briefcase with other papers. That's the last I saw of it. It probably fell into the waste paper basket when I pulled the papers out of the briefcase. Anyway, I haven't found it." "So you wanted him to get you another, and this time he was less compliant?" "You could put it like that. He must have been thinking things over in the vacation. You'd think I'd ruined his life instead of contributing to his sexual education." Dalgliesh said, "And within a week, he was dead." "Well, I'm not responsible for that. I didn't want him dead." "So you think it could have been murder?" This time she gazed at him, appalled, and he saw both surprise and terror in her eyes. "Murder? Of course it wasn't murder. Who the hell would want to murder him? It was accidental death. He started poking around in the cliffs and brought the sand down on himself. There was an inquest. You know what the verdict was." "When he refused to hand over a second consecrated wafer, did you attempt blackmail?" "Of course not." "Did you even by implication suggest that he was now in your power? That you had information that could get him expelled from the college, ruining his chances of ever being ordained?" "No," she said vehemently. "No, I didn't. What the hell would be the use? It would compromise Eric, for one thing, and for another, those priests would believe him, not me. I wasn't in a position to blackmail him." "You think he realized that?" "How the hell do I know what he thought? He was half crazy, that's all I know. Look, you're supposed to be investigating the murder of Crampton. Ronald's death has nothing to do with this case. How could it have?" "I suggest you leave me to decide what has or has not to do with this case. What happened when Ronald Treves came to St. John's Cottage on the night before he died?" She sat there in sullen silence. Dalgliesh said, "You and your brother have already withheld information vital to this investigation. If we'd been told on Sunday morning what we've now learned, someone might have been under arrest. If neither you nor your brother had anything to do with Archdeacon Crampton's death, I suggest you answer my questions honestly and truthfully. What happened when Ronald Treves came to St. John's Cottage on that Friday night?"
"I was there already. I'd come down from London for the weekend. I didn't know he was going to call. And he had absolutely no right to walk into the cottage like he did. Okay, we've got used to leaving doors open, but the cottage is supposed to be Eric's home. He came barging upstairs and, if you must know, found Eric and me in bed. He just stood in the doorway and stared. He looked crazy, absolutely crazy. And then he started spitting out ridiculous accusations. I can't really remember what he said. I suppose it could have been funny, but actually it was rather frightening. It was like being ranted at by a lunatic. No, that's the wrong word. It wasn't a rant. He didn't shout or scream. He hardly raised his voice. That's what made it rather terrifying. Eric and I were naked, which put us at a bit of a disadvantage. We just sat up in bed and stared at him while that high voice went on and on. God, it was weird. Do you know, he'd actually thought I was going to marry him? Me, a parson's wife? He was mad. He looked crazy, and he was crazy." She told it with a puzzled incredulity, as if confiding to a friend over a drink in a bar. Dalgliesh said, "You seduced him, and he thought you loved him. He gave you a consecrated wafer because you asked, and he could refuse you nothing. He knew precisely what it was he had done.
And then he saw that there never had been love, that he had been used. The next day he killed himself. Miss Surtees, do you in any way feel responsible for that death?
She cried vehemently. No, I don't. I never told him I loved him. It wasn't my fault if he thought I did, and I don't believe he killed himself. It was an accident. That's what the jury found, and that's what I believe.
Dalgliesh said quietly, I don't think it is, you know. I think you know very well what drove Ronald Treves to his death.
Even if I do, that doesn't make me responsible. And what the hell did he think he was doing, barging in like that and rushing upstairs as if he owned the place? And now I suppose you'll tell Father Sebastian and get Eric thrown out of the cottage.
Dalgliesh said, No, I shall not tell Father Sebastian. You and your brother have put yourselves in considerable peril. I can't impress on you too strongly that what you've told me must remain secret. All of it.
She said ungraciously, All right. We're not going to speak. Why should we? And I don't see why I should feel guilty about Ronald or about the Archdeacon. We didn't kill him. But we thought you'd be ready enough to think we did if you got a chance. Those priests are sacrosanct, aren't they? I suggest you start looking at their motives instead of picking on us. And I didn't think it would matter not telling you about Eric going to the church. I thought one of the students had killed the Archdeacon, and he'd confess anyway. That's what they're going for, isn't it? Confessions? I'm not going to be made to feel guilty. I'm not cruel, and I'm not callous. I was sorry for Ronald. I didn't bully him into giving me that wafer. I asked him, and in the end he agreed. And I didn't have sex with him to get the wafer. Okay, that was part of it, but it wasn't the whole. I did it because I was sorry for him, and because I was bored, and maybe for other reasons which you wouldn't understand and would disapprove of if you did. There was nothing else to be said. She was frightened, but she was not ashamed. Nothing he could have said would have made her feel responsible for Ronald Treves' death. He thought now of the desperation which had driven Treves to that appalling end. He had been faced with the stark choice of staying on at St. Anselm's with the constant threat of betrayal and the tormenting knowledge of what he had done, or confessing to Father Sebastian with the almost certainty that he would have to return home to his father as a failure. Dalgliesh wondered what Father Sebastian would have said and done. Father Martin would, he thought, have shown mercy. He was less sure about Father Sebastian. But even if mercy had been shown, how could Treves have stayed on with the humiliating knowledge that he was there on probation? At last he let her go. He felt a profound pity and an anger which seemed directed against something deeper and less identifiable than Karen Surtees and her insensitivities. But what right had he to feel anger? She could claim her own kind of morality. If you promised to provide a consecrated wafer, you didn't cheat. If you were an investigative journalist, you took the job seriously, conscientious, even in deceit. There had been no meeting of minds. There never could be. It was for her inconceivable that anyone would kill himself for a small disc of flour and water. For her, the sex had been little more than a relief from boredom, the satisfying power of initiation, a new experience, the lightly taken exchange of pleasure. To take it more seriously led at best to jealousy, demands, recriminations, and mess. At worst, to a mouth choked with sand. And hadn't he, in his solitary years, separated his sexual life from commitment, even if he had been more fastidious and prudent in his choice of partner and more sensitive to the hurt of others? He wondered what he would say to Sir Alred. Probably merely that an open verdict would have been more logical than one of accidental death, but that there was no evidence of foul play. But there had been foul play. He would keep Ronald's secret. The boy had left no suicide note. There was no way of knowing whether in those last seconds and too late he might have changed his mind. If he had died because he couldn't bear his father to know the truth, it wasn't for him, Dalgliesh, to reveal it now. He became conscious of the prolonged silence and of Kate sitting beside him, wondering why he didn't speak. He was aware of her contained impatience. He said,
"Right, we're getting somewhere at last. We've found the missing key. That means that Kane did, after all, go back into the college and return the one he used. And now we find that brown cloak."
Kate said, her voice echoing his thoughts, "If it still exists to be found."
9. Dalgliesh called Piers and Robbins into the interview room and put them in the picture. He said, "You checked all the cloaks, brown and black?"
It was Kate who replied,
"Yes, sir.
Now that Treves is dead, there are 19 students in residence and 19 cloaks. 15 students are absent, and all except one, who went home to celebrate his mother's birthday and wedding anniversary, have taken their cloaks. That means there should have been 5 in the cloakroom when we checked, and there were. They've all been examined pretty carefully, and so have the cloaks of the priests."
"Do the cloaks have name tabs?"
"I didn't look when I first checked on them."
It was Piers who replied.
"All of them. Apparently they're the only clothes that do. I suppose it's because they're identical except for size. There's no cloak in college without a name tab."
They had no way at present of knowing whether the killer had actually worn the cloak during the murderous attack. It was possible, even, that there had been a third person waiting in the church when the archdeacon arrived, someone whom Surtees hadn't glimpsed. But now that they knew that a cloak had been worn, and almost certainly by the killer, all 5 cloaks, although apparently clean, would have to be scientifically examined by the lab for minute traces of blood, hairs, or fibers. But what about the 20th cloak? Was it possible that it had been overlooked when Ronald Treves' clothes were bundled up for return to his family after his death? Dalgliesh thought back to the interview with Sir Alred at New Scotland Yard. Sir Alred's chauffeur had been sent with another driver to collect the Porsche and had taken the parcel of clothes back to London with him. But had it contained a cloak? He tried to force memory into recollection. There had been a mention, surely, of a suit, shoes, and certainly a cassock, but had he mentioned a brown cloak? He said to Kate, "Get Sir Alred for me. He gave me a card with his home address and phone number before he left the yard. You'll find it on the file. I imagine he's unlikely to be there at this time, but someone will be. Tell them I have to speak to him personally and that it's urgent." He had expected difficulty. Sir Alred wasn't a man to be readily accessible by telephone, and there was always the possibility that he wasn't in the country. But they were lucky. The man who answered the telephone at his home, although reluctantly convinced of the urgency, gave the number of Sir Alred's Mayfair office. Here they were answered by the usual upper-class, unaccommodating voice. Sir Alred was in a meeting. Dalgliesh said that he must be fetched. Could the commander please wait? The delay was unlikely to be for more than 3/4 of an hour. Dalgliesh said that he was unable to wait even for 3/4 of a minute. The voice said, "Will you hold on, please?" Within less than a minute, Sir Alred was on the phone. The strong, authoritarian voice came over unworried, but with a note of controlled impatience.
"Commander Dalgliesh, I was expecting to hear from you, but hardly in the middle of a conference. If you've any news, I'd rather hear it later. I take it this affair at St. Anselm's is related to my son's death?"
Dalgliesh said, "There's no evidence to suggest that at present. I'll get in touch with you about the inquest verdict as soon as I've completed my investigations. In the meantime, murder has priority. I wanted to ask you about your son's clothes. I remember your telling me that they were returned to you. Were you present when the parcel was opened?"
"Not when it was opened, but shortly afterwards. It isn't something I'd normally have taken an interest in, but my housekeeper, who dealt with it, wanted to consult me. I told her to take the clothes to Oxfam, but the suit was the same size as her son wore, and she asked me whether I would be happy if she gave it to him. She was also worried about the cassock. She didn't think that would be any use to Oxfam, and wondered if she ought to send it back. I told her that, as they'd got rid of it, they'd hardly be interested in seeing it returned, and that she could dispose of it in any way that occurred to her. I think it was put into the dustbin.
Is that all?
And the cloak. A brown cloak?
There was no cloak. You can be sure of that, Alred?
No, of course I can't. I didn't open the parcel. But if there had been a cloak, it's likely Mrs. Mellors would have mentioned it. Asked me what I wanted done with it. As far as I remember, she brought in the whole parcel to me. The clothes were still in the brown paper, the string partly wrapped around. I can see no reason why she should have removed the cloak.
I take it that all this is relevant to your inquiries?
Very relevant, Sir Alred. Thank you for your help. Can I reach Mrs. Mellors at your house?
The voice had grown impatient.
I've no idea. I don't control my servant's movements. She does live in, so I imagine she could be contacted. Good day, Commander.
They were fortunate, too, with the return call to the Holland Park house. The same male voice answered the telephone, but said that he would put through the call to the housekeeper's flat.
Mrs. Mellors, once assured that Dalgliesh had spoken to Sir Alred and was ringing with his approval, took this on trust, and merely said that, yes, she had been the one to open the parcel of Mr. Ronald's clothes when they were returned from St. Anselm's, and had made a list of the contents. There had been no brown cloak. Sir Alred had kindly given permission for her to take the suit. The rest of the items had been taken by one of the staff to the Oxfam shop at Notting Hill Gate. The cassock she had thrown away. She had thought that it was a pity to waste the material, but she couldn't imagine that anyone would want to wear it. She added, somewhat surprisingly for a woman whose confident voice and intelligent responses had sounded rational, "The cassock was found by his body, wasn't it? I'm not sure I would have liked to wear it. There was something rather sinister about it, I thought. I did wonder whether to cut off the buttons. They could have come in useful, but I didn't like to touch it. To tell you the truth, I was glad to see it go into the bin."
After he had thanked her and put down the receiver, Dalgliesh said, "So, what happened to the cloak, and where is it now?" "The first step is to speak to the person who parceled up the clothes. Father Martin told me that it was done by Father John Betterton."
10. In front of the great stone fireplace in the library, Emma was giving her second seminar. As with the first, she had little hope of distracting the thoughts of her small group of students from the other, more grimly sober activities which were being carried on around them. Commander Dalgliesh hadn't yet given permission for the reopening and rehallowing services which Father Sebastian had planned. The scene of crime officers were still on the job, arriving early in the morning in a sinister little van which someone must have driven from London for their use, and which was parked outside the front entrance in defiance of Father Peregrine's objections. Commander Dalgliesh and his two detective inspectors still pursued their mysterious inquiries, and the lights burned late at night in St. Matthew's Cottage. The students had been forbidden by Father Sebastian to discuss the murder. In his words, "to connive in evil and aggravate distress by ill-informed and speculative gossip." He could hardly have expected the prohibition to be observed, and Emma wasn't sure that it had been helpful. Certainly the speculation was discreet and spasmodic, rather than general or prolonged. But the fact that it had been forbidden only added guilt to the weight of anxiety and tension. Open discussion, she felt, would have been better. As Raphael said, "Having the police in the house is like being invaded by mice. Even when you don't see or hear them, you know they're there." The death of Miss Betterton had added little to the weight of distress. It was no more than a second but softer blow on nerves already anesthetized by horror. The community, having accepted that the death was accidental, tried to distance it from the horror of the Archdeacon's murder. Miss Betterton had been rarely seen by the Ordinance, and only Raphael genuinely mourned for her. But even he seemed to have gained some kind of balance since yesterday. a precarious equilibrium between withdrawal into his private world and flashes of hard acerbity. Since that moment of talk on the headland, Emma hadn't seen him alone. She was glad. He wasn't easy to be with. There was the seminar room at the back of the house on the second floor, but Emma had chosen to use the library. She told herself that it was more convenient to have the books she might need for reference close at hand, but knew that there was a less rational explanation for her choice. The seminar room was too claustrophobic, in atmosphere, if not in size. However frightening the presence of the police, it was more bearable to be at the heart of the house than closeted on the second floor, isolated from activity which it was less traumatic to hear than to imagine. Last night she had slept, and slept well. Security locks to the guest sets had been fitted and the keys handed over. She was grateful to be sleeping in Jerome rather than next to the church with that dominant and obscurely threatening window. But only Henry Bloxham had mentioned the change. She had overheard him speaking to Stephen. "I understand that Dalgleish asked to change sets so that he can be next to the church. What, is he expecting the murderer to return to the scene of the crime? Do you think he sits up all night watching from the window?" No one had spoken of it to her. Occasionally on her visits to St. Anselm's, one or more of the priests, if not otherwise occupied, would sit in at her seminar, always first asking her permission. They never spoke, nor did she ever feel that she was being assessed. Today the four ordinands were joined by Father John Betterton. As usual, Father Peregrine was silently at work at his desk at the far end of the library, seemingly impervious to their presence. A small fire had been lit in the grate, more for comfort than for additional heat, and they sat round it in low chairs, except for Peter Buckhurst. He had chosen a high back and sat upright and silent, his pale hands resting on the text as if he were reading Braille. This term Emma had planned that they should read and discuss the poetry of George Herbert. Today, rejecting the ease of familiarity for a more demanding poem, she had chosen the quiddity. Henry had just finished reading aloud the last verse. "It is no office, art, or news, nor the exchange or busy hall, but it is that which while I use, I am with thee, and most take all." There was a silence. Then Stephen Morby asked, "What does quiddity mean?" Emma said, "What a thing is, its essence." And the final words, "I am with thee and most take all." It sounds like a misprint, but it obviously isn't. I mean, we'd expect the word must, not most. Raphael said, "The note in my edition says it refers to a card game. Winner takes all. So I suppose Herbert's saying that when he's writing poetry, he holds the hand of God, the winning hand." Emma said, "Herbert is fond of gaming puns. Remember the church porch? This could be a card game where you give up cards in order to obtain better ones. We mustn't forget, Herbert's talking about his poetry. When he's writing it, he has everything because he's one with God." His readers at the time would have known the card game he was referring to. Henry said, "I wish I did. We should do some research, I suppose, and find out how it was played. It shouldn't be difficult." Raphael protested, "But pointless. I want the poem to lead me to the altar and silence, not to a reference book or a pack of cards." Agreed. This is typical Herbert, isn't it? The mundane, even the frivolous, sanctified. But I'd still like to know. Emma's eyes were on her book, and she was only aware that someone had come into the library when the four students simultaneously rose to their feet. Commander Dalgleish stood in the doorway. If he was disconcerted to find that he had interrupted a seminar, he didn't show it, and his apology made to Emma sounded more conventional than heartfelt. "I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were using the library. I'd like a word with Father John Betterton and was told I'd find him here."
Father John, a little flustered, began to edge himself out of his low leather chair. Emma knew that she was blushing, but since there was no way of concealing the telltale flush, made herself meet Dalgliesh's dark, unsmiling eyes. She didn't get up, and it seemed to her that the four ordnance had moved closer to her chair, like a cassock-clad bodyguard silently confronting an intruder. Raphael's voice was ironic and overloud. "The words of Mercury are harsh after the songs of Apollo." "The poet detective. Just the man we need. We're grappling with a problem with George Herbert. Why not join us, Commander, and contribute your expertise?" Dalgliesh regarded him for a few seconds in silence, then said, "I'm sure Miss Lavenham has all the expertise necessary. Shall we go, Father?" The door closed behind them, and the four ordnance sat down. For Emma, the episode had had an importance beyond the words spoken or the glances exchanged. She thought, the Commander doesn't like Raphael. He wasn't, she felt, a man who would ever let personal feelings intrude into his professional life. Almost certainly he wouldn't now. But she felt quietly that she hadn't misread that small spark of antagonism. What was odder was her own brief moment of pleasure at the thought.
11.
Father John Betterton trotted beside him across the hall, out of the front door and round the south of the house to the cottage, accommodating his short legs to Dalgliesh's stride like an obedient child, his hands folded within his black cloak. He seemed more embarrassed than worried. Dalgliesh had wondered how he would react to police questioning. In his experience, anyone whose previous encounters with the police had resulted in arrest was never afterwards at ease with them. He had feared that Father Betterton's trial and imprisonment, which surely must have been for him an appallingly traumatic experience, might have left him unable to cope. Kate had described how he had reacted with stoically controlled revulsion to the taking of his prints. But then few potential suspects welcomed this official thieving of identity. Apart from this, Father John had seemed less obviously affected, both by the murder and by the death of his sister, than were the rest of the community, preserving always the same look of puzzled acceptance of a life which had to be endured, rather than possessed. In the interview room, he seated himself on the edge of the chair with no sign that he was expecting an ordeal. Dalgliesh asked, "Were you responsible, Father, for packing up Ronald Treves' clothes for return to his father?" Now the faint impression of embarrassment was replaced by an unmistakable guilty flush. "Oh, dear. I think I may have done something foolish. You wanted to ask about the cloak, I expect."
"Did you send it back, Father?"
"No. No, I'm afraid I didn't. It's rather difficult to explain." He was still more embarrassed than frightened as he looked across at Kate. "It would be easier if I could have your other officer here, Inspector Tarrant. You see, it's all rather embarrassing."
That wasn't a request to which Dalgliesh would normally have agreed, but the circumstances were unusual. He said, "As a police officer, Inspector Miskin is used to embarrassing confidences, but if you would feel happy..."
"Oh, yes, indeed, yes, please, I should. I know it's foolish of me, but it would be easier."
At a nod from Dalgliesh, Kate slipped out.
Piers was busy upstairs, seated at the computer. She said, "Father Betterton has something to say unsuitable for my chaste female ears. AD wants you. It looks as if Treves' cloak was never sent back to Dad. If so, why the hell weren't we told before? What's wrong with these people?"
Piers said, "Nothing. It's just that they don't think like policemen."
"They don't think like anyone I've ever met. Give me a good old-fashioned villain any day."
Piers gave up his seat to her and went down to the interviewing room. Dalgliesh said, "So exactly what happened, Father?" I expect Father Sebastian told you that he asked me to bundle up the clothes. He thought, well, we thought, that it wouldn't be fair to ask one of the staff to do it. The clothes of dead people are so personal to them, aren't they? It's always a distressing business. So I went to Ronald's room and got them together. He didn't have much, of course. The students aren't encouraged to bring too many possessions or clothes with them, only what is needed. I put the things together, but when I was folding the cloak, I noticed that... He hesitated and then said, well, I noticed that it was stained on the inside.
How was it stained, Father?
Well, it was obvious that he'd been lying on the cloak and making love.
Piers said, it was a semen stain?
Yes. Yes, it was. Quite a big one, really. I felt I didn't want to send the cloak back to his father like that. Ronald wouldn't have wished me to, and I knew, well, we all knew, that Sir Alred hadn't wanted him to come to St. Anselm's, hadn't wanted him to be a priest. If he'd seen the cloak, he could have made trouble for the college.
You mean a sexual scandal?
Yes, something like that. And it would have been so humiliating for poor Ronald. It was the last thing he would have wanted to happen. It wasn't very clear in my mind, but it just seemed wrong to send the cloak back in the state it was in.
Why didn't you attempt to clean it?
Well, I did think about that, but it wouldn't have been very easy. I was afraid that my sister would see me carrying it about and ask me what I was doing. And I'm not very good at washing things. And of course I didn't want to be seen doing it. The flat is small and we had, very little privacy from each other. I just put the problem aside. I know it was silly, but I had to get the parcel ready for Sir Alred's chauffeur, and I thought I would deal with it another time. And there was another problem. I didn't really want anyone here to know. I didn't want Father Sebastian to be told. You see, I knew who it was. I knew the woman he had been making love to.
Piers said, so it was a woman?
Oh, yes, it was a woman. I know I can tell you this in confidence.
Dalgleish said, if it has no bearing on the murder of the Archdeacon, there's no reason why anyone but ourselves should know it. But I think I can help you.
Was it Karen Surtees?
Father Betterton's face showed his relief.
Yes, it was. Yes, I'm afraid that's right. It was Karen. You see, I'm rather fond of bird-watching, and I saw them through my binoculars. They were in the bracken together. Of course I didn't tell anyone. It's the kind of thing Father Sebastian would find it very difficult to overlook. And then there's Eric Surtees. He's a good man, and he's happy here with us and his pigs. I didn't want to say anything that would upset the arrangement. And it didn't seem such a terrible thing to me if they loved each other, if they were happy together. But of course I don't know how it was with them. I don't know anything about it, really. But when one thinks of the cruelty and pride and selfishness which we often condone, well, I couldn't feel that what Ronald did was so very terrible. He wasn't really happy here, you know. He didn't fit in somehow, and I don't think he was happy at home either. So perhaps he needed to find someone who would show him sympathy and kindness. Other people's lives are so mysterious, aren't they? We mustn't judge. We owe the dead our pity and understanding as well as the living. So I prayed about it and decided to say nothing. Only, of course, I was left with the problem of the cloak.
Dalgleish said, Father, we need to find it quickly. What did you do with it?
I rolled it up as tightly as I could and pushed it to the back of my wardrobe. I know it sounds foolish, but it seemed sensible at the time. They didn't really seem any hurry about it. But the days passed and it became more difficult. Then, on that Saturday, I realized I must make some kind of decision. I waited until my sister was taking a walk. I took one of my handkerchiefs and held it under the hot tap and rubbed it well with soap and managed to clean the cloak quite effectively.
I rubbed it dry with a towel and held it in front of the gas fire. Then I thought the best thing would be to take off the name tab so that people weren't reminded of Ronald's death. After that, I went down and hung it in the cloakroom on one of the pegs. That way, if any of the ordnance forgot their cloaks, they could use it. I decided that after I'd done that, I would explain to Father Sebastian that the cloak hadn't been sent off with the other clothes without giving an explanation. I'd tell him I'd hung it in the cloakroom. I knew he'd just assume I'd been careless and forgotten about it. It really seemed the best way. Dalgliesh had learned from experience that to hurry a witness was to invite disaster. Somehow he controlled his impatience. He said, "And where is the cloak now, Father?" "Isn't it on the peg where I hung it? The peg on the extreme right? I hung it there just before Compline on Saturday. Isn't it still there?" "Of course I couldn't check, not that I thought of it, because you've locked the cloakroom door." "When exactly did you hang it there?" "As I've explained, just before Compline. I was one of the first to go into the church. There were very few of us, with so many students away, and their cloaks were hanging in a row. Of course I didn't count them, I just hung Ronald's cloak where I've told you, on the last peg." "Father, did you at any time wear the cloak while it was in your possession?" Father Betterton's puzzled eyes looked into his. "Oh, no, I wouldn't have done that. We've our own black cloaks. I wouldn't have needed to wear Ronald's." "Do the students normally wear their own cloaks only, or are they, as it were, communal?" "Oh, they wear their own. I dare say sometimes they may get muddled, but that wouldn't have happened last night. None of the ordnance wear their cloaks to Compline, except in the bitterest winter. It's only a short walk to the church along the north cloister, and Ronald would never have lent his cloak to anyone else. He was very fussy about his belongings." Dalgliesh asked, "Father, why didn't you tell me this earlier?" Father John's puzzled eyes looked into his. "You didn't ask me. But didn't it occur to you that when we examined all the cloaks and clothes for blood, that we would need to know if any were missing?" Father John said simply, "No. And it wasn't missing, was it? It was on a peg in the cloakroom with the others." Dalgliesh waited. Father John's mild confusion had deepened into distress. He looked from Dalgliesh to Piers and saw no comfort in their faces. He said, "I hadn't thought about the details of your investigation, what you were doing or what it all might mean. I didn't want to, and it didn't seem any of my business. All I've done is to try to answer honestly any questions you've put to me." It was, Dalgliesh had to admit, a complete vindication. Why should Father John have thought the cloak significant? Someone more knowledgeable in police procedure, more curious or interested, would have volunteered the information even if not expecting it to be particularly useful. Father John was none of these things, and even if it had occurred to him to speak, the protection of Ronald Treves' pathetic secret would probably have seemed more important. Now he said contritely, "I'm sorry. Have I made things difficult for you? Is it important?" And what, thought Dalgliesh, could he honestly answer to that? He said, "What is important is the exact time you hung the cloak on the end peg. You're sure that it was just before Compline?" "Oh, yes, quite sure. It would have been 9:15. I'm usually among the first into the church for Compline. I was going to mention the matter to Father Sebastian after the service, but he hurried away and I didn't get the chance. And next morning, when we all heard about the murder, it seemed such an unimportant thing to worry him with." Dalgliesh said, "Thank you for being so helpful, Father. What you've told us is important. It is even more important that you keep it private. I'd be grateful if you wouldn't mention this conversation to anyone." "Not even to Father Sebastian?" "Not to anyone, please. When the investigation is over, you'll be free to tell Father Sebastian as much as you choose. At present, I don't want anyone here to know that Ronald Treves' cloak is somewhere in college."
"But it won't be somewhere, will it?"
The guileless eyes looked at him. Won't it still be on the peg?
Dalgleish said, It isn't on the peg now, Father, but I expect we'll find it.
Gently he steered Father Betterton to the door. The priest seemed suddenly to have become a confused and worried old man. But at the door he gathered strength and turned to speak a few last words.
Naturally, I shan't tell anyone about this conversation. You've asked me not to do so, and I won't. May I please also ask you to say nothing about Ronald Treves' relationship with Karen?
Dalgleish said, If it is relevant to the death of Archdeacon Crampton, it will have to come out. Murder is like that, Father. There's very little we can keep secret when a human being has been done to death. But it will only be revealed if and when it is necessary.
Dalgleish impressed on Father John again the importance of telling no one about the cloak and let him go.
There was, he thought, one advantage of dealing with the priests and ordinance of St. Anselm's. You could be reasonably certain that a promise, once given, would be kept.
12. Less than 5 minutes later, the whole team, including the Sockos, were behind the closed doors of St. Matthew's cottage. Dalgleish reported the new development. He said,
Right, so we begin the search. We need first to be clear about the 3 sets of keys. After the murder, only 1 set was missing. During the night, Surtees took a set and didn't return it. That set has been recovered from the pigsty. That means that Kane must have taken the 2nd set and replaced it after the murder. Assuming that Kane was the figure wearing the cloak, this could be hidden anywhere, inside the college or out. It's not an easy thing to conceal, but Kane had the whole headland and shore available, and plenty of time between midnight and 5:30. It could even have been burnt. There are plenty of ditches crossing the headland where a fire wouldn't be noticed even if someone were abroad. All he would need would be some paraffin and a match.
Piers said, I know what I'd have done with it, sir. I'd have fed it to the pigs. Those animals will eat anything, particularly if it's blood-stained, in which case we'll be lucky to find anything except perhaps the small brass chain at the back of the neck.
Dalgleish said, Then look for it. You and Robbins had better make a start with St. John's cottage.
We've been given authority by Father Sebastian to go where we like, so no warrant is necessary. If any of the people in the cottages makes trouble, we may need a warrant.
It's important no one knows what we're looking for.
Where are the ordnance at present, does anyone know?
Kate said, I think they're in the lecture room on the 1st floor. Father Sebastian is giving them a seminar on theology.
Well, that should keep them occupied and out of the way. Mr. Clark, will you and your team take the headland and the shore? I doubt whether Kane would have made his way through that storm to chuck the cloak into the sea, but there are plenty of hiding places on the headland. Kate and I will take the house.
The group dispersed, the Sockos turning seaward, and Piers and Robbins making their way toward St. John's cottage. Dalgleish and Kate went through the iron gate into the west courtyard. The north cloister was now free of leaves, but nothing of interest had been discovered from the Sockos' meticulous search except the small twig, its leaves still fresh, on the floor of Raphael's set. Dalgleish unlocked the door of the cloakroom. The air smelt unfresh. The 5 hooded cloaks hung on their pegs in a sad decrepitude, as if they had been there for decades. Dalgleish put on his search gloves and turned back the hood of each cloak. The name tabs were in place. Morby, Arbuthnot, Buckhurst, Bloxham, Macaulay. They passed into the laundry room. There were 2 high windows with a formica-top table beneath them, and under it 4 plastic laundry baskets. To the left was a deep porcelain sink with a wooden draining board on each side and a tumble dryer. The 4 large washing machines were fixed to the right-hand wall. All the porthole doors were closed. Kate stood in the doorway while Dalgleish opened the 1st 3 doors. As he bent to the 4th, she saw him stiffen and went up to him. Behind the thick glass, blurred but identifiable,
were the folds of a brown woolen garment. They had found the cloak. On the top of the machine was a white postcard. Kate picked it up and silently passed it to Dalgliesh. The writing was black. The letters were meticulously formed. This vehicle should not be parked in the forecourt. Kindly remove it to the rear of the building. P.G. Dalgliesh said, "Father Peregrine, and it looks as if he turned off the machine. There are only about 3 inches of water here." Kate said, "Is it bloody?" And bending, peered close. "It's difficult to see, but the lab won't need much to get a match. Ring Piers and the Sarkos, will you, Kate? Call off the search. I want this door removed, the water drained off, and the cloak sent to the lab. I need hair samples from everyone at St. Anselm's." Thank God for Father Peregrine. If a machine this size had gone full cycle, I doubt whether we'd have got anything useful, either blood, fibers, or hair. Piers and I will have a word with him. Kate said, "Surely Kane was taking an extraordinary risk. It was crazy coming back, even crazier to set the machine going. It was only by chance we didn't find the cloak earlier." "He didn't mind if we did find it. He may even have wanted it found. All that mattered was that it couldn't be linked to him. But he must have known that there was a risk that Father Peregrine would wake up and turn off the machine." "No, he didn't know, Kate. He was one of the people here who never uses those machines. Remember Mrs. Munro's diary? George Gregory had his washing done by Ruby Pilbeam." Father Peregrine was sitting at his desk at the west end of the library, hardly visible behind a pile of volumes. No one else was present. Dalgliesh said, "Father, did you turn off one of the washing machines on the night of the murder?" Father Peregrine lifted his head and appeared to take some seconds recognizing his visitors. He said, "I'm sorry. It's Commander Dalgliesh, of course. Of what are we speaking?" "Saturday night. The night Archdeacon Crampton was killed. I'm asking if you went into the laundry room and turned off one of the machines." "Did I?" Dalgliesh handed over the postcard. "You wrote this, I presume? Those are your initials. This is your handwriting?" "Yes, that is my hand, certainly." "Dear me, seems to be the wrong card." "What did the right one say, Father?" "It said that ordnance should not use the washing machines after Compline. I go to bed early and sleep lightly. The machines are old, and when they start up, the noise is extremely disrupting. The defect, I understand, is in the water system rather than in the machines themselves. But the cause is immaterial. Ordnance are supposed to keep silence after Compline. It is not an appropriate time to do their personal laundry." "And did you hear the machine, Father? Did you place this note on it?" "I must have done. But I expect I was half asleep at the time and it slipped my mind." Piers said, "How could it have slipped your mind, Father? You weren't too sleepy to write the note, find a card and a pen." "Oh, but I explained, Inspector. This is the wrong note. I have quite a number already written. They're in my room, if you care to see." They followed him through the door that led into his cell-like room. There, on the top of the crowded bookcase, was a cardboard box containing some half-dozen cards. Dalgliesh rifled through them. "This desk is for my use only. Ordnance should not leave their books here. Kindly replace the books on these shelves in their precise order. These machines should not be used after Compline. In future, any machines working after 10 o'clock will be turned off. This board is for official notices only, not for the exchange of trivia by ordnance." All bore the initials PG. Father Peregrine said, "I'm afraid I was very sleepy. I picked up the wrong card." Dalgliesh said, "You heard the machine start up sometime in the night and went out to turn off the noise. Didn't you realize the importance of this when Inspector Miskin questioned you? The young woman asked me whether I had heard anyone come in or leave the building, or whether I'd gone out myself.
I remember the words exactly. She told me I must be very precise in answering her questions. I was. I said no. Nothing was said to me about washing machines.
Dalgliesh said, the doors of all the machines were closed. It's usual, surely, for them to be left open when not in use.
Did you close them, Father?
Father Peregrine said complacently, I can't remember. But I expect I did. It would be a natural thing to do. Tidiness, you know. I dislike seeing them left open. There's no good reason for it.
Father Peregrine's thoughts seemed to be on his desk and the work in hand. He led the way back into the library and they followed him. He settled himself down at the desk again, as if the interview were over.
Dalgliesh said with all the force he could command, Father, are you at all interested in helping me to catch this murderer?
Father Peregrine, not in the least intimidated by Dalgliesh's 6 feet 2 inches towering over him, appeared to consider the question as a proposition rather than an accusation. He said, Murderers should be caught, certainly, but I don't really think I'm competent to help you, Commander. I have no experience of police investigation. I think you should call on Father Sebastian or Father John. They both read a great deal of detective fiction, and that probably gives them an insight. Father Sebastian lent me a volume once. I think it was by a Mr. Hammond Innes. It was too clever for me, I'm afraid.
Piers, speechless, raised his eyes to heaven and turned his back on the debacle.
Father Peregrine dropped his eyes to his book, but then showed signs of animation and looked up again.
Just a thought. This murderer, having done his murdering, would surely want to make his getaway. I expect he had a getaway car ready outside the West Gate. The expression is familiar to me. I can't believe, Commander, that he would think it a convenient time to do his personal laundry. The washing machine is a kipper.
Piers muttered, Red herring, and took a step away from the desk as if he could bear no more.
Father Peregrine said, Kipper or red herring, the meaning is the same. Red herrings were, of course, the staple protein on this coast for many years. It's a curious word. I imagine the etymology is Middle English, kipra, from the Old English, sipra.
I'm surprised you don't use it in place of red herring.
You could say that an investigation was kippered when its success was jeopardized by irrelevant and misleading information.
He paused, then added, like my note, I'm afraid.
Dalgliesh said, And you saw and heard nothing when you left your room.
As I have explained, Commander, I have no memory of having left my room. However, the evidence of my note and the fact that the machine was turned off seems incontrovertible. Certainly, if anyone had entered my room to take the postcard, I should have heard. I'm sorry not to be more helpful.
Father Peregrine again turned his attention to his books, and Dalgliesh and Piers left him to his work.
Outside the library, Piers said, I don't believe it. The man's mad, and he's supposed to be competent to teach postgraduates.
And does it brilliantly, so I'm told.
I can believe it. He wakes, hears a noise he detests, pads out half asleep and picks up what he thinks is his usual note, then fumbles back into bed.
The difficulty is that he doesn't for one moment believe that anyone in St. Anselm's is a murderer. He doesn't admit the possibility to his mind. It's the same with Father John and the brown cloak. Neither of them is trying to obstruct us. They are not being deliberately unhelpful. None of them thinks like a policeman, and our questions seem an irrelevance. They refuse to accept even the possibility that someone at St. Anselm's was responsible.
Piers said, Then they're in for one hell of a shock.
And Father Sebastian, Father Martin.
They've seen the body, Piers. They know where and how. The question is, do they know who? 13. In the laundry room, the dripping cloak had been carefully lifted and placed in an open plastic bag. The water, so faintly pink that the color seemed more imagined than real, was siphoned into bottles and labeled. Two of Clark's team were dusting the machine for prints. It seemed to Dalglish a pointless exercise. Gregory had worn gloves in the church and was unlikely to have taken them off before he returned to his cottage. But the job had to be done. The defense would look for any opportunity to question the efficiency of the investigation. Dalglish said, "This confirms Gregory as prime suspect. But then he was from the time we knew about the marriage. Where is he, by the way, do we know?" Kate said, "He drove to Norwich this morning. He told Mrs. Pilbeam he'd be back by mid-afternoon. She cleans his cottage for him, and she was there this morning." "We'll question him as soon as he returns. And this time I want the interview recorded under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. Two things are important. He mustn't know that Treves's cloak was left in college or that the washing machine was turned off. Speak to Father John and Father Peregrine again, will you, Pierce? Be tactful. Try to ensure that the message gets through to Father Peregrine." Piers went out. Kate said, "Couldn't we get Father Sebastian to announce that the door to the north cloister is open and that students can use the laundry room? We could then keep watch to see if Gregory comes for the cloak. He'll want to know if we've found it." "Ingenious, Kate, but it will prove nothing. He's not going to fall into that trap. If he does decide to come, he'll bring some soiled washing with him. But why should he? He planned for the cloak to be found. One more piece of evidence to convince us that this was an inside job. All that concerns him is that we can't prove that he wore it on the night of the murder. Normally, he'd have been safe. It was bad luck for him that Surtees went to the church on Saturday night. Without his evidence, there would have been no proof that the murderer wore a cloak. Bad luck for him, too, that the machine was turned off. If the washing cycle had been completed, any evidence would almost certainly have been destroyed." Kate said, "He could still claim that Treves had lent him the cloak sometime previously. But how likely is that? Treves was a young man jealous of his possessions. Why would he lend anyone his cloak?" "But you're right. That will probably be part of his defense." Piers had returned. He said, "Father John was in the library with Father Peregrine. I think they've both got the message. But we had better wait for Gregory and intercept him as soon as he arrives back." Kate asked, "And if he wants a lawyer?" Dalglish said, "Then we'll have to wait until he gets one." But Gregory had no wish for a lawyer. An hour later, he seated himself at the table in the interview room with every appearance of calm. He said, "I think I know my rights and just how far you are permitted to go without incurring the expense of a lawyer. Those that would be any good I can't afford, and those I can afford wouldn't be any good. My solicitor, although perfectly competent when it comes to drawing up a will, would be an irritating encumbrance to us all. I didn't kill Crampton. Not only is violence repugnant to me, I had no reason to wish him dead." Dalglish had decided that he would leave the questioning to Kate and Piers. Both sat opposite Gregory, and Dalglish himself moved to the east-facing window. It was, he thought, a curious setting for a police interview. The barely furnished room with the square table, the four upright chairs and the two armchairs was just as they had first seen it. The one change was a brighter bulb in the single overhanging light over the table. Only in the kitchen, with its collection of mugs and the faint smell of sandwiches and coffee, and in the more comfortably furnished sitting room opposite, where Mrs. Pilbeam had actually provided a jug of flowers, were there any signs of their occupation. He wondered what a casual watcher would have made of the present scene, of this bare functional space, of the three men and one woman so obviously intent on their private business. It could only be an interrogation or a conspiracy, and the rhythmic booming of the sea emphasized the atmosphere of secrecy and menace. Kate switched on the machine, and they went through the preliminaries.
Gregory gave his name and address, and the three police officers stated their names and ranks. It was Piers who began the questioning. He said, Archdeacon Crampton was murdered at about midnight last Saturday. Where were you after 10 o'clock that night? I told you that earlier, when you first questioned me. I was in my cottage listening to Wagner. I didn't leave the cottage until I was summoned by telephone to attend Sebastian Morel's assembly in the library. We have evidence that someone went to Raphael Arbuthnot's room that night. Was it you? How could it be? I just told you I didn't leave my cottage. On 27 April 1988, you married Clara Arbuthnot, and you have told us that Raphael is your son. Did you know at the time of the marriage that the ceremony would make him legitimate, the heir to St. Anselm's? There was a slight pause. Dalgliesh thought, he doesn't know how we found out about the marriage. He's not sure how much we know. Then Gregory said, I wasn't aware of it at the time. Later, and I can't remember when, it came to my knowledge that the 1976 Act had legitimized my son. At the time of the marriage, did you know the provisions of Miss Agnes Arbuthnot's will? There was no hesitation now. Dalgliesh was confident that Gregory would have made it his business to know, probably by research in London. But he wouldn't have done that under his own name, and could be reasonably sure that this at least was evidence they wouldn't easily find. He said, No, I didn't know. And your wife didn't tell you before or after the marriage? Again the slight hesitation, the flicker of the eyes. Then he decided to take a risk. No, she didn't. She was more concerned with saving her soul than with financial benefit to our son. And if these somewhat naive questions are intended to stress that I had motive, may I point out that so did all four resident priests. Piers broke in. I thought you told us you were unaware of the provisions of the will. I wasn't thinking of pecuniary advantage. I was thinking of the obvious dislike felt for the Archdeacon by virtually everyone in college. And if you're alleging that I killed the Archdeacon to ensure an inheritance for my son, may I point out that the college was scheduled to close. We all knew that our time here was limited. Kate said, Closure was inevitable, perhaps, but not immediate. Father Sebastian might well have negotiated a further year or two, long enough for your son to complete his training and to be ordained. Was that what you